Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your resident crank slash host, Lady P, no relation to Master P, and currently chowing down on the bountiful fruit salad of life is today's guest, Minister of All Internet Happenings over at Film 4, it's Michael Leader. Welcome back to the show, Michael.
Thanks so much, Lady P. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, enjoy that. Enjoy those strawberries while you can, you know. Mm-hmm. And rounding out our little panel is a man who regularly rages against the dying of the light, as well as the hippity-hop and the dubbity-step. Please welcome back to the show, Mr. Dave Eves. Welcome back, Dave!
Thank you. How do you say hello in Swedish?
I'm going with allo.
Allo?
Allo?
Sure, I should have said that.
Allo?
That works.
I think it's hey, actually.
Hey!
Hey!
What's up?
All right, on today's show, we have the 63rd movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, the ultimate sad old man movie. It's Ingmar Bergman's 1957 film, Wild Strawberries. 63 seems to be the magic number for the critics. Also tied for that spot is Modern Times, Night of the Hunter, Sunset Boulevard, Rio Bravo, and Pickpocket. That's some tight competition, but we'll see how Bergman's wistful road trip through childhood remembrances stacks up to the rest of our recent string of great movies. And while we're on a septuagenarian kick, that's how you say that word, for our second topic, we're going to talk about movies featuring elderly people coming to terms with their advancing years. Some are reflections on life gone by, others are about making new adventures no matter one's age. We'll talk about which depictions we prefer and give examples of some of our favorites. Then we'll close things out with some final notes of positivity. All right, you guys ready to delve into the life and loves of Isaac Borg?
Let's do this.
Let's do it.
Yeah, all right. Okay, good, because resistance is futile. Oh my God, I told that joke. Star Trek people will get it anyway.
Star Trek was known for having those long road trips and
absolutely
going back into your past and reflecting on everything you've done before.
It's true. yeah, well, I guess Gene Roddenberry was a Bergman fan and decided to name his best villains after Isaac Borg. Anyway. Wild Strawberries begins with a dream, or rather a nightmare. An elderly man is haunted by visions of handless clocks and ghost carriages which chase him down an empty corridor. A cadaver version of the same man pulls him down into his grave where nothing but darkness awaits. That is until the film abruptly jerks us into consciousness. As with all Bergman films, the difference between the dreamscape and actual waking life isn't always easy to determine. But in this case, we learn definitively that this was the unconscious mind of one Isaac Borg, played here by famed silent film director Victor Sjostrom. Correct me on pronunciation if you wish. Isaac is an elderly professor emeritus who spent the majority of his existence cooped up in a lab, content to study bacteria and other microscopic organisms in lieu of actual human engagement. However, after this opening nightmare sequence, he's roused to go out and experience whatever remains of his life. After regaining his bearings and shaking off the initial terror of this existential call to action, he determines that he's going to set off in the morning on a 16-hour drive from Stockholm to Lund, where he is set to receive an honorary degree that evening. His daughter-in-law, Marianne, with whom he shares a respectful but affectionless bond, joins him for the journey. Along the way, father and daughter-in-law have a series of encounters which prompts Isaac to dig deep into his memory banks and reflect on the various relationships he's lost and neglected throughout his many years. They pick up a trio of hitchhikers, one of whom is named Sarah. Sarah calls for Isaac his first love, who also happened to be named Sarah. This encounter sets Isaac off on a series of flashbacks to his youth, where he revisits painful childhood memories. We see the original Sarah fall in love with Isaac's brother. Then in another dream sequence, Sarah scolds Isaac for his remoteness and his apparent disinterest in other people. By the way, the Sarahs, both the young hitchhiker and the one from Isaac's youth, are played by Bergman regular B.B. Anderson. Yay, B.B. Anderson. Through these series of encounters, both the real and imagined, Isaac is able to take stock of his life and come to terms with the mistakes he's made in his past and hopefully take some steps to repair some of his current relationships. Like so many Bergman films, Wild Strawberries depicts finally observed Weltschmerz and deep-seated familial resentments, which eventually manifest as casual cruelties. By the way, Weltschmerz, what a great word. Leave it to the Germans. In many ways, it's the same horror show we've come to know from the Ingmar Bergman who would go on to create The Silence and Cries and Whispers. But unlike in Bergman's later work, the characters in Wild Strawberries are not without redemption. Well, perhaps it was just a fleeting moment of youthful optimism, but this early Bergman depicts human fallibility with compassion and, dare I say it, with humor. Yes, there are actual honest-to-goodness laughs to be had in this film, and not to spoil anything, but there's also a pretty moving, hopeful ending. The conclusion of the film suggests that even in the twilight of one's years, there's still time to grow and change and mend old wounds. My panelists can step in if they disagree, but I'm going to go ahead and say this is Bergman at his most sentimental, and I, for one, can't get enough. But what do you guys think? Dave, I'll start with you. Thoughts on Wild Strawberries?
Well, anyone that knows me remotely knows that I am a Bergman-obsessed movie watcher. And I don't know if this is Bergman at his most sentimental.
Okay.
I might hand that over to Fanny and Alexander.
Okay.
But this is definitely one of his best films. I would say of his pre-60s work, it's probably my favorite. It's kind of almost, it's near the end of what I'd consider early Bergman. And I think it's really remarkable what a film still made by a man who was, what, in his like really early 40s was able to accomplish in terms of maturity and telling the tale of an older man. You would think that this was literally something made by an old guy trying to talk about his own mortality, but it's in fact made by a young man.
Yeah.
And I just can't get enough of it.
All right. Michael, what do you think? Wild Strawberries.
I'm not a Bergman obsessive. In fact, I only really watched a handful of his movies, but Wild Strawberries is probably, you know, the favorite of the ones I've seen. I first saw it maybe 15 years ago now, and rewatching it, I'm just struck by how so many of those dream sequences had stuck in my mind. They're just so sort of casually groundbreaking and have been, you know, influential and kind of picked over by filmmakers ever since. I think that it's interesting. It is such a sentimental film that goes somewhat against the kind of gloomy Swede stereotype that is associated with Bergman, and I'm sure Dave can help us correct that in the conversation as we go through. But it's such a you know, coming back from Cannes, where I saw a lot of very serious European movies, this is a serious European movie that at least is 96 minutes long as well.
Thank
so
God.
It manages to be so economical in what it's doing.
That's worth mentioning, especially given the length of something like Fanny and Alexander, which I understand is a miniseries, but
all of his non-miniseries stuff is right around 90 minutes, which is great in case you can't take too much existential dread at once.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that is, they are generally mercifully short. And that's not to say I don't enjoy watching his films, but I do often have a sense that I kind of need to steel myself for them. You know, I sort of need to have put up some kind of mental fortification before watching any of his movies.
You just don't unwind with a nice margarita,
you know?
and a Bergman flick? Nice summer summer evening, you know what? I just want to kick back, put on Persona and
That's
Cries
right.
and Whispers. And
That's right. It's a good time.
Take a nice nap.
It's a good party flick, you know?
Yeah. That's a good,
gather your friends.
It's a good movie to put on when you want the party to end.
Exactly, yeah. Well, let's talk about, we're sort of dancing around this kind of joke. What does it mean? What do you think of when you think of Ingmar Bergman?
I think of emotions boiling over. Mm-hmm. I think I consider myself somewhat more of an emotionally reserved person. So I think it's always great to see movies that I think come from another emotionally reserved culture that manages to kind of take things to its breaking point, like a champagne cork popping off. And that's when you get those great little digs into other people's personalities, these just huge insult rants that are fantastic, and just all these emotions coming up. and doing so in a, yes, they can be considered depressing, but one of Bergman's like big philosophies is that, yeah, life kind of sucks, but there's always great moments that you can go back on and remember. And life is really the nice moments between the horrible moments. And I think in all of his films, even if they all seem horribly depressing, there is always kind of some moment of clarity, of happiness to be found.
Mm, yeah. I guess, well, let's talk about when we how we first experienced this movie and kind of if we've come back to it over the years or... I know I, for one, this is one of the very first Bergman movies I saw, Wild Strawberries, that is. And I just remember feeling like it was just a revelation, just one of the most beautiful works of art that I've ever seen. And I've been like a Bergman fan ever since, though I don't know that I have loved any of them as much as I loved this one. That said, I think Persona might be my favorite now, but just because that movie is so strange. but then I remember watching, shortly after seeing this film, Wild Strawberries, I remember watching The Virgin Spring and feeling so just completely just wrecked and disappointed that the same guy who made Wild Strawberries made The Virgin Spring, because it has the... And obviously that's a classic, and I'm pretty sure it's on the Sight and Sound list. I could be wrong about that. But people seem to think that is among his best works. But that same kind of humanism that you see in this film, it's there in The Virgin Spring, but it's almost like mocking you. I don't know. So... there's sort of it's such a delicate balance between kind of just a human, you know, human's capacity for evil and the you know, the small moments of kind of beauty. And so I guess it really depends. I think it's interesting how some of them really can speak to you and others maybe are leave you feeling miserable. I don't know, like your takeaway, your mileage may vary, you know. And I don't know, yeah, I guess, but Dave, are you someone who, generally speaking, his whole outlook on life is sort of, it just generally jives with you?
Oh, it totally jives with me.
Yeah,
And The Virgin Spring is a particularly draining one, so I totally understand that, especially if you're coming back off of Wild Strawberries, which it ends hopeful, which is uncommon. Sometimes the nice moment happened somewhere near the middle or the beginning, and things just get worse from there. I don't know. Like sometimes it's great to be like, you know what? Let's just let the emotions fly on the screen. Let's just see where things go. Let's get it all out there.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that, and I especially appreciate his experimentation in ways of trying to do that, like something like Through a Glass Darkly, where he, like Wild Strawberries is a pretty big melodrama in a sense. There's a larger cast. We're going through time periods. We're going through through someone's subconscious.
Yeah.
We're taking a literal trip through all of Sweden, even though it was almost all shot on a soundstage. And then you have something that's really tiny, like Through a Glass Darkly, where it's like, let's just do four characters, pretty much a single location. Let's see if we can still have those big emotions. And I just appreciate his constant striving to try to do something different, try to do something better and see where we can still get all of these emotions and really quantify, I guess, the human experience through film and his own fears and longings and desires and put it all on the screen and just create this body of work.
Yeah. Michael, how about you? What's your relationship to Bergman? I know you're not an obsessive, but how do you respond to Wild Strawberries versus some of his other works?
What I find fascinating about Wild Strawberries and what really struck me when I watched it was, I'd feel free to correct me, but I still think that Bergman's sort of popular estimation is based on, you know, The Seventh Seal and Persona. To a certain extent. So seeing him work in a more humanistic, melodramatic, dramatic, you know, mold. And then you see that later with the other films of his that I've seen in the 70s and so on, where it is just family domestic situations.
That was a lot of his bread and butter. I think it's interesting how The Seventh Seal and Persona became the most popular ones, because they are slightly different from his norm.
But then he became this sort of sense. In a way, I was talking with some colleagues recently. It feels that Kubrick and Tarkovsky and some of these major 20th century filmmakers who only made relatively few pieces of work are able to change with the generations in terms of how they're looked at and how they're defined. But you look at someone like Bergman, who's made so many movies, I wonder if that is something that is a roadblock in a way. And certainly in the last decade or so here, it's been quite difficult to see many of his movies. The DVD label that released the entire Bergman back catalogue went out of business about 6 years ago. And they're only recently becoming back in circulation. In fact, Mubi right now in the UK is doing a 6 month retrospective.
Okay,
good time for us.
That was convenient.
And
it means that I'll be able to watch a few of those films that I've missed, I guess, over the years. But I feel that he's definitely somebody who's worth a reappraisal and a real deep dive into some of those smaller films.
Absolutely.
And I wonder why. Is it because of the size of his back catalogue, you think, that people don't reassess? And where are the think pieces?
Sure, yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess it's so easy to just say Wild Strawberries, Seventh Seal, Persona, maybe Fanny and Alexander, or just maybe take the ones that were nominated for Best Foreign Film, an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film, and that's, there you have Bergman.
And that's pretty much the same list.
Yeah, exactly. basically them right there. But there is so much there. It's almost a little unwieldy, just where to begin. And then once you've gotten past the initial, the cornerstones, the big ones, like, do you have the strength to keep going? I guess is the other issue, right?
I've said it before, I'll say it again. I'm surprised that all of these depression-obsessed millennials haven't really latched onto these movies.
Right. True. But it's sort of like the kind of misanthropy that characterizes Bergman. I don't know if you would... I think of him as being a misanthrope.
I won't disagree with that.
Yeah, I think that millennials are not into hating life. These things are always subject to change, but there is like a real hatred of other people that I think might be a little bit, I don't want to say dated, because, but...
I'm right there with it.
Yeah, yeah. There. Nice.
And it seems his films, at least the ones I've seen, are quite inward looking, right? Maybe that would be a roadblock for a generation who's much more about intersectionality and activism and coming together.
Like that.
That's a good point.
That's a very nice characterization of our generation. Thank you.
The kindest thing I've ever heard about us.
Let's go with that. But yeah, I don't know. I guess when I was younger, I think the darker nihilistic side really spoke to me. And now I do find, now that I've softened a bit, I still find that there is much to explore and latch onto in his work, and particularly in Wild Strawberries. But let's talk specifically about the film. Let's delve into some of the formal stuff. One thing that may feel a little bit, I don't know, dated or of its time are the very kind of literal dream sequences. Like, they're rife for very literal interpretations. What do you guys think about the sort of depiction of the unconscious, to use a Freudian term?
Well, talk about the first dream sequence, which is the one that is most immediately horrific. I think that is there are some ropey elements to the way dream sequences are displayed across the film, especially the use of harp as a transitional motif. Which feels very, I don't know, Looney Tunes or something. But the use of almost surrealistic imagery of clocks with no hands and a figure facing away and turning around and not being like a human figure, I think are still quite strong, even though it recalled, you know, Chandelou for me. I think that's quite a powerful sequence. The other sequences are more straightforward and almost played into a more of a literary tradition. It felt more like a Christmas Carol, Dickensian, being a figure in a memory, but that's not a memory, because I find it really fascinating that he's not present in nearly all the dream sequences he has that are meant to be memories.
Right.
So he almost becomes a kind of passive figure in his own life.
Right. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, clearly, especially the initial dream sequence, it's drawing off of a strong surrealist tradition. I immediately, like, the image that it recalled for me was like a De Chirico painting, the sort of like early proto-surrealist Italian painter. This is sort of like empty streets and shadows, and just playing with history and weird juxtaposition of imagery. It's so striking. And again, it's sort of recalled for me 8.5, the Fellini movie, right? It's sort of, there's something almost Fellini-esque about it, perhaps.
He did like Fellini.
Well, there you go.
He even tried to make a Fellini movie, and it didn't work.
Oh, which one is the Fellini movie?
All These Women.
Okay.
It's a weird screwball comedy.
Oh, okay.
It's a very interesting experiment that I think demands to be seen.
I'm going to have to check that out. I have not seen it.
It's kooky. I also really like that.
Yeah, Bergman doing kooky. I love it.
It does not quite work. There's a whole scene with a guy juggling with a statue, trying not to knock it over.
Okay.
but anywho.
Perfect.
I really like how that first dream sequence just looks visually different from anything else in the film, because it's just slightly overexposed. And everyone's wearing dark clothing, so the clothing has, you can really see the texture of the clothing, but the faces are almost blown out. And it's a style that he uses a couple times throughout his work to kind of show that something's slightly out of the ordinary, or try to bring in anxiety or suspense. And even with the later dream sequences, they're still shot more like reality. That's the only thing it's kind of completely separate from the rest of the film.
Yeah. Back to Michael's point about how Isaac is sort of observing his life as an outsider. Like, the scenes that play out don't necessarily involve him, and they aren't memories. It's almost as if he's being given a tour of his life. The film that it most recalled for me is actually It's a Wonderful Life. It's sort of like the dark version of It's a Wonderful Life. It's the misanthropic version of It's a Wonderful Life, where, in fact, you existed and you had very little impact. You know what I mean? that's the Bergman version of the Capra story. You know,
Have either of you guys seen Victor Sjostrom's film The Phantom Carriage? That was like the movie that inspired Bergman to make movies. It's made by the main character in this film, and it's basically It's a Wonderful Life before It's a Wonderful Life.
Nice.
In which the story is, if you're the last person to die on New Year's Eve, you are doomed to become death for the next year.
Ah.
And Victor Sjostrom, however you pronounce his name, gets hit in the head with a bottle as the clock strikes midnight, and his friend that had become death the year before takes him through his life to show him how much of a horrible person he was. So, and it's kind of like a Christmas Carol, but that was actually like the framework that was kind of used for It's a Wonderful Life. And I think that's why this film kind of feels like it parallels both of those and is kind of like the dark version of that.
Perfect. Yeah.
But I think it's interesting that also, like, within his own way that he sees his life. He sees himself as a side player that had very little impact. But then there's a scene at a gas station where a minor character played by Max von Sydow talks about how great he's been to the people of this town that he's just passing through. And he doesn't have any memories of that. Right. He's never going back and reflecting over the positive impact. Clearly, he does not care for himself very much.
Right, yeah.
And also the key scene at the end where he's finally receiving the great honor that you've been building up to in the whole film. The speech is given in Latin. Right. So we're not even really hearing properly what it is that he's being so honored for, apart from being around for so long.
Right, yeah. It's good you brought up Victor Sostrom again. Apologies. So it's kind of a stroke of genius, that casting. Let's talk about sort of what he brings to the role besides the obvious allusion to this Phantom Carriage film that he directed. Let's talk about who is Victor Sostrom. And what do you make of his performance?
He was a pretty prolific Swedish filmmaker, and I think he was also a stage actor. He had a brief stint in Hollywood where they changed his name to Seastorm because Seastrom, something was a little bit more easily pronounced by us Americans that don't speak Swedish.
Right.
Then he went back to Sweden, and I think his career kind of fizzled. And this was the guy that kind of inspired Bergman to make movies. He was in one other one prior with a smaller part. He was in To Joy as an orchestra conductor. And Bergman had said, like, there's only one way I'm going to make this film, and it's if I have Victor Sjostrom as the main part, and if he turns it down, I'm not going to make it. And he was very reluctant, apparently. Mm. Because he was just like, I'm like 78 at the time. He was getting up there. He only died 3 years after this was made. And he just didn't feel as though he had the strength to do it. And the only way, one of the caveats that he would allow to do it is that as long as he was home in his house to have his 5 o'clock shot of whiskey, then he could do it.
Right. It's good. He has his priorities, you know. he needed to steal himself, or maybe he's been watching Bergman movies. Anyway, what do you make of his performance? To me, it's sort of curious that he's playing this sort of austere, emotionless scientist kind of person that people either discount or resent, because I just look at his face and I think he just looks so kindly. He looks like a sweet old man. Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, that brings a certain tension to the film, that he's depicted, you know, by others as being, you know, quite an arch figure, but he has such a kind face and such an expressive face, and I wonder whether that is because he comes from a more silent tradition. But it brings a sort of tension to the character. He says in voiceover that he limits their interaction with the troubles of others and so on, and engaging in gossip and so on. But he is such there is some sort of natural compassion to his expressions and his interactions with the people, and I don't know whether that certainly adds to the film for me, because it adds a certain ambiguity to that character. As in, is this something that as he's growing older he has developed into, or is this something that is has he had a bad rap throughout his life? Right, but he's certainly got this incredibly expressive face that works so well in close-up, and certainly, you know, in the dream sequences, as Dave said, when that first one was quite overblown. But all the way throughout, the way that his face can crumple into a frown, and he has those very expressive eyebrows, or a smile with his sort of crooked old man teeth.
Right.
It's such a wonderful kind of classic silent movie face to look at. He's really fantastic in the role, I think.
Yeah. And, I mean, I guess the only real evidence we have to suggest that he might have been a little bit different in his younger years are obviously the sort of character testimonials that we get from the flashbacks. But then also there's his son, it sort of jives more with what people have been telling us about Isaac. The son is sort of cold and, as you say, arch and very dismissive of his wife. And that maybe there is, in that regard, there is some evidence to suggest that he might have been different when he was younger and that he has softened. But otherwise, yeah, the eyebrows, how could this, the man with the untended eyebrows be so cruel and cold? Not possible.
I think one good outlook you could have on this movie, because I think that the son is supposed to represent exactly how he was in his youth, even though we don't really see it. You can almost see this as like a Ebenezer Scrooge the day after he's had his like revelation that he needs to be nicer, but no one's buying it.
Right, right. Yeah, that's good. It's the Christmas Carol sequel. I like it.
Things don't go well.
Yeah.
I brought everyone a turkey. Get out of here.
Yeah. That's nice. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Gee.
There. Yeah. Let's talk about the rest of the cast of characters, specifically B.B. Anderson, the Sarahs. I love her. I don't know. She brings such vivacious femininity to the role. It's also a specific kind of anguish, but maybe that's just because I'm thinking of Persona. but I just love her. And I love both versions of her. but yeah, what do you make of the sort of her role as Sarah, both of the Sarahs, and the decision to have her play both this the historical Sarah and the young sort of bohemian hippie, the road tripper version.
With her stylish 1957 haircut.
I know, it's so cute. and then I love the two different wigs she wears. They couldn't be more different. Like the country, the quiet country girl.
Can't choose which cousin to fall in love with.
It's true. Oh, poor thing.
the problems of the late 19th century.
It's so true. But I don't know. I guess for me, Sarah, is Sarah a person, or are both versions kind of manifestations of some kind of idealized form of Sarah that Isaac has? Because there's something sort of convenient about both of them. There's something very manic pixie dream girlish about both of them, you know, and that they're both this weird kind of ideal of femininity.
I have a weird theory on this.
Okay, sure.
That I think that the current one is the real one, and obviously the past one is an idealized version, but I think that even though we see the dream version before we see the real one, I kind of think that the real one informs the dream. I think this movie kind of follows that weird dream logic where when you're dreaming, it's following one path, but then something changes and you say, oh yeah, everything before this was like this too, and you kind of rewrite it as you're going along. So I kind of feel as though that's why we have B.B. Anderson in two places. We have this current embodiment of youth, this current embodiment of femininity. And we even know that the Sarah that Isaac knew is a young man. I believe he says that she's still alive. And he talks about how she's a very nice older woman, but we never meet her as that. We never see the reality. It's only the dream version that's kind of been informed by this new person that he's met that's kind of much more modern, much more... much more youthful and vivacious, like you said. Mm-hmm. And I think it kind of flows through both paths that way.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I guess the sense that her sort of vitality and enthusiasm is contrasted with Marianne's, who might be my favorite character in the movie.
She's the rock.
Yeah, she
holds
fantastic.
It together.
Yeah.
I was really struck rewatching this film that her main costume looks like David Bowie's Thin White Duke. This sort of amazing white shirt and kind of black waistcoat type thing. She looks incredible.
Yeah. I love that. She's sort of this like essence of cool about her. And I'm not exactly sure where that's coming from, but
she's stoic.
She is stoic, but not in a removed kind of way. She's
going right at you. She's going to go for your throat, but not going to break a sweat.
Exactly. But in a nice way, very cordial. Mm-hmm. Time for you to leave now, you know, when they encounter the bickering couple. but yeah, she's sort of someone who has to maintain the kind of optimism as embodied by the young while maintaining a sort of... I don't know. She has to kind of be a balance between some kind of neutral ballast between the youthful optimism of Sarah and her two lovers and the cynicism of Isaac and her husband. And she manages that balance beautifully in both cases. Like, she's just very, very cool. And then at the end, spoilers, you know, when they establish that there is this mutual bond, this sort of beyond respectful bond has grown, it's more of like a just real actual affection has developed between the two of them, it makes that that ending so much more impactful. Because I don't know, the first time I saw the movie I cried. I was like, that's so, they like each other, it's so beautiful. But yeah, I think she in her low-key way kind of makes the movie.
I fully agree.
So, and then there is one other notable female character in the movie that I think we should probably talk about.
Oh, of course.
Yes. Should we talk about Mommy? Dear old Mum.
I remember the first time I saw this movie, I saw Isaac Borg, and I was like, this guy is ancient. What do you mean his mom's still around?
Yeah, I know. How is that possible? Do you think she was 12 when she had him, and that's why she's so bitter?
No, I think she was 90 then.
Yeah.
When she had him, and she's 300 now.
Yeah.
And she's going to outlive him and everyone else.
Yep.
And I love also, this is something I did not catch the first time I saw the movie, because this is one of the first Bergmans that I've seen. That's like Bergman's like go-to old lady.
Nice.
Anytime he needs an old lady in his movies, he uses that really stern old lady to just kind of drill through your soul.
Oh, man. it's so funny because Bergman was about 40 years old when he made this movie. And he really just could not manage to get along with his parents throughout his entire life. And like one begins to wonder whether like his parents were actually the problem or if he just like was using this resentment as fodder for his filmmaking. This is all just speculation. I have no idea. But that was something that really just struck me after watching a few more, especially of his later movies, like Autumn Sonata, which I love.
Mm. Autumn Sonata is great. I feel so like, I think there's a constant dichotomy between him blaming his parents and then blaming himself. And I think Autumn Sonata might be a really good mix because he later was just like, oh yeah, I've been a horrible parent to my kids too. What did I do?
Yeah.
but this movie itself, this is around a time that when he was trying to reconnect with his dad, and the character of Isaac Borg, even though it's a lot of Bergman, he says that it's his father is who he's trying to portray.
Mm. I mean, in that sense, he's being charitable, I guess. And it's really the criticism is if the son figure is a version of himself, if that's the kind of director proxy, then I don't know. I mean, it's not outlandish to say like there's a lot of self-hatred involved with any kind of Bergman movie.
I think one of the first things people talk about, because I was watching a couple interviews, like, did you intentionally make the main character's initials the same as yours? And he's just kind of like, oh, did I do that?
Interesting. How about that?
Huh. I'm sure it's just a coincidence.
Yeah. Ay, ay, ay. But yeah, I guess this is a pretty prevalent theme throughout his work, is this sort of intergenerational conflict that we've talked about that on the show and on the Leopard episode, Dave, as you'll recall.
I've not listened to that episode.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, curious.
How about that?
Yeah. And I don't remember, did Bergman come up at all when we discussed this?
I think I kept it to a minimum.
Okay.
I think I kept myself under control.
But this is like prime material for that. And it's not so much like this generation is this way and this generation is this way and there is now conflict. It's like people are hard. You will mess up your children no matter what you do, because you're awful and they're awful. That's great.
The tradition of awfulness continues.
The legacy of awful. The Ingmar Bergman story.
But at least there was that one time that we had wild strawberries, so everything's cool.
It's true. Oh, all right. Well, is there anything else we wanted to mention before I ask the final question? Michael, anything else?
I'd like to pick over the final dream sequence, which you say it's this cycle of awfulness, but it does end on a happy memory for him.
Sure, yeah.
And he's actually in that memory. It's him looking for his parents, and he comes out into a clearing and sees them fishing. And then the music rises, and it's he's smiling and wakes up in bed, and it seems to be the happy end of a long day. Mm-hmm. And is that how you guys read it? Is that what's happening in that scene? He just happens to be this beautiful kind of almost landscape painting of a family life.
Right.
Or how do we read that?
I think, at least in my experience, even horrible, even things that I remember as being difficult from my past, when I look back, I usually look back on them fondly. When I'm in a good mood, I generally look back and see only the positive parts of life. It's very likely that on that fishing trip, his parents were bickering and made everything kind of unpleasant. But just prior to that, was a moment of promise, of happiness. So I guess that's kind of my interpretation, is like the subjective nature of memory and kind of how nostalgia plays on our memories and stuff like that, how it affects our memories.
Yeah, and it's crucially just a visual memory and not one of necessarily an incident or a conversation.
Sure, yeah.
Maybe he's just happy that the humiliating dreams are over.
Right, exactly. At last, a reprieve. It's true.
The movie itself is just a road trip. He literally, because he even was supposed to fly from Stockholm to, I forget the town that he ends up in,
Lund.
But he decides, Lund. But he wants to kind of take this road trip through memory, because he's driving through places that he's been in his past, and he does arrive at the final destination. He arrives at that, oh my God, why can't I think of the word? There is a sense of just freedom kind of at the end, where he is able to finally arrive at, oh, there was some happiness in my life. And I think you're right. I think that is exactly what that is, that there is relief there at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, and crucially, not the final destination, I like your phrasing there, that you might expect.
Yeah.
This could very easily be a Sundance movie where at the end, he just dies.
Right, yeah. I was so happy that he does not die. I was waiting for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're right, that is, I guess the Sundance movie, that's a perfect description of this movie, ends with his death, right? Life comes to a very nice, neat, tidy conclusion.
He dies, and there's a montage of all the people that he's affected feeling sad.
Exactly.
Played with some indie pop rock song underneath
it.
Perfect.
Totally.
That's how it really should have ended, Ingmar.
See it now. Yes, indeed. But yeah, there's a next chapter there. This is just a day, and it wasn't that taxing. You know, it was just a drive.
He went for a Sunday drive.
Yeah. There is no reason for him to die at the end. So kudos to you, Ingmar, for showing some restraint. That's where I thought it was going when I first saw the movie, and I'm happy that it didn't end that way. Anyway, all right, last question. This is Wild Strawberries is the 63rd movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. is it worthy of the 63rd spot? Just a little reminder, it is tied with Rio Bravo, Sunset Boulevard, Modern Times, Night of the Hunter, and Pickpocket. Stiff competition. But what do you guys think? Michael, let's start with you.
You know, I think it's a great movie. I really do. And I think that its position in culture is quite solid. Maybe, you know, Woody Allen has banged on about it too much across his career, but
perhaps, yeah.
Certainly one of the totem poles in European cinema. What I find really interesting, and this came up when we were talking about Barry Lyndon, was a film that in the director's poll for Sight and Sound was very high comparatively to its general critics poll. Wild Strawberries has only one vote in the director's poll. So actually, but there's quite a lot of Bergman represented in that list. It's just not Wild Strawberries that directors are pointing at. So I wonder whether there is a disconnect between what filmmakers now may take from this film versus what critics take.
Yeah.
And I do wonder, as we were saying earlier, if there is a new generation coming at Bergman and finding different things from his films and maybe pointing towards his later colour movies versus, the two films he made in the same year that made his name in the 50s.
Right.
Whether we'll see a shift as things go on.
Right. Yeah. That's very curious.
Considering that it's up against Night of the Hunter, which I feel is a film that is just growing with age.
Sure.
Becoming, a cult movie. Sunset Boulevard 2 is just growing with every generation.
Absolutely. Yeah. I take it from that response that you think 63 is a little high.
Personally, it wouldn't necessarily make my five if I submitted to the poll, but I have no problem with this being in the top 100. I want people to see this.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is
definitely
a canonical film.
Fair. All right. Dave, what do you think?
I think it's in really good company. Those are all great movies.
Sure.
I would say that it's fine where it is if there was more Bergman represented before it, but I think this is the second Bergman.
It is.
On the top 250, Persona's higher, and I agree with that. I think Persona is a little low on the poll, to be honest. And I would put more Bergmans between Persona and Wild Strawberries.
Interesting.
I would put it probably like sixth on my Bergman top 10. So I'm going to say if they're not going to put any other Bergmans on the list before this, bump it up higher. If there are other Bergmans filling out the poll, it's fine where it is.
Okay. All right. Interesting. I guess I think that I'd like to see more variety in the filmmakers. So what's been very frustrating has been having to watch all of Godard's films while basically not with, like, I think 63 is the first, or no, I guess Some Like It Hot is the first Wilder, and that's in the 40s or 50s or something like that. So I'm inclined to say, like, Persona may be too low, although that's in the top 20, right?
I think it should be in the top 10, though.
Well, fair.
That's where
fair.
I'm coming from.
Fair, yeah, yeah. So to me, like, the idea that Bergman would have two in the top 100 seems pretty, that's pretty great.
I'm not going to disagree with you there.
Okay, fair.
but I agree with you, though, that perhaps Jean-Luc Godard is a bit overrepresented.
Yeah.
But where I'm coming from is if he's in there four times, then so should Bergman.
Yeah.
So should everyone else.
That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. I guess there are just certain directors that this go around, this incarnation of the list seem to be just obsessed with. Like, you know, there's, I guess, most of Tarkovsky's major works are in the top 50. There's all the Godard. There's, there's quite a few Hitchcocks in there. So I guess just a little bit more variety, variety in filmmakers. But that said, Wild Strawberries and Persona are my top two Bergman films. So I do think, I'm glad that those made the top 100.
Dave, could I ask what your top five, the films you'd place between Wild Strawberries and Persona would be?
So, with Persona at the anime beginning, I would say Cries and Whispers. Mm. I would say Fanny and Alexander. Mm. I would say Hour of the Wolf. Mm. And then I'd probably put Winter Light.
Interesting. Okay. Oh my God. So much darkness.
That's gracious. A dark night.
Yeah.
Have yourself a dark night with those four movies.
Good gracious.
I will.
Yeah.
Well, it's longer than a night, right? Because Fanny Alexander is.
Well, that's true.
Fanny and Alexander is great because it's the TV version, so you can just watch like an hour here, an hour there.
Yeah.
You can really spread it out.
Yeah. Yeah, really take it all in. That's
exactly.
Great. Yeah. All right. Great. Well, we'll leave you to it, audience, listening audience.
Carriage, return.
The history of cinema is chock full of coming-of-age tales. Stories of children hesitantly or defiantly moving into adulthood. Here at FlixWise, we even did a whole series of favorites entries about the greatest teen movies of all time. Indeed, Hollywood has long been accused of being youth-obsessed and focusing on subjects that appeal primarily to adolescents. But every now and again, a filmmaker will take on subjects that are slightly more mature in age. It's ripe for consideration. What do people think and feel when the top of the hourglass only has a couple grains of sand left? When the marrow of life has supposedly been sucked dry. It's a weighty topic, to be sure, but hopefully we can approach it with some humor and deftness, just as many filmmakers have. Today, we're going to compare the different ways that movies typically approach depicting people of advanced age in comparison to the way they approach more youthful subjects. Plus, we'll each list off some of our favorite films starring elderly people. I feel like there's got to be like a good... more nicer euphemism than elderly people, right?
Old fogies.
And old folks, yeah. Decrepids. Crones. I guess that's too gendered. Anyway, we're going to talk about old people. Okay, so where to begin? Let's start with what we mean by old people. Because that means different things to different people. Obviously, in the context of Wild Strawberries, it probably refers to people who are 75 plus. But if we're talking about... I can't tell you when I typed in movies about old people, how often Whatever Happened to Baby Jane came up.
Mm.
And they're women in their 50s, 60s, you know? Basically, movies about aging, more often than not, if it stars a woman, they're generally in their 40s or 50s. So I think maybe we should be clear about what we mean when we talk about our sort of coming of old age topic, right? What does it mean to you to be a movie about old age? Dave, I'll start with you.
I think the character should have to be eligible for Social Security.
Okay. 65 plus. Okay.
65 plus. Because when I was trying to do research too, even in my mind, and this is terrible how the Hollywood machine has shaped my mind, it's just like, oh, Sunset Boulevard. I'm like, right. Wait, no, she's like 50.
Yeah.
But within Hollywood terms, I guess that's ancient.
Ancient.
Especially in that context.
Yeah.
But no, these are people that literally are into their golden years and need to kind of face the mortality ahead and the past behind them, just like Isaac Borg.
Mm-hmm. Michael, how about you? What do you think of when you think of old age?
I wouldn't necessarily say 65 plus. I think because Hollywood has such a kind of Peter Pan problem where there are actors well into their 50s playing like they're still in their 30s. We're talking about, you know, Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt, and so on.
Sure.
That any film that I think even approaches middle age, say, you know, 45 and up, with any sense of seriousness, seems significant and mature compared to a 50-year-old jumping away from explosions.
Right.
My top five may therefore have some... I'm not saying that such people are old by being in this top five.
Right.
But it's certainly something different from youthful coming of age.
Right, right. So it's just kind of more focused on contending with aging.
Mortality, having a second life after living your first life, some other major life development happening beyond growing up, going through puberty, going to college, having your first love, which seems to be, that's 90% of kind of romantic comedies or comedy dramas.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. What happens? Yeah. The next chapter. Yeah. Why do you have a theory about why this isn't, this subject isn't broached as regularly as, say, the first love? Beyond, I mean, I guess there's less romance to it. There's a sadness to it. But what do you think the reticence, where does the reticence to tackle these subjects come from?
I think people like to see young people.
Yeah.
They think youth sells. But there is a market for really crappy movies that are about this. I'm not going to judge here, but there's lots of movies that are like The Bucket List, where it's just like, hey, there's this old guy that used to work for us. We need to, or this old actor that needs to make money. How can we turn this into something? It's like, oh, how about three retired people try to rob a bank?
Right.
Or these three people are going to go to Las Vegas and we're going to call that Las Vegas because Robert De Niro still needs work.
Right.
Yep. I'm trying to remember the name of the bank one.
I think it's the Tough Guys. Freeman. Yeah, yes. Morgan Freeman, Michael Caine, and Alan Arkin. Directed by Zach Braff.
Ooh.
Yeah. But it's the same. It's the same in the UK as well. We now have a generation of actors who were, you know, legendary in the 70s, 80s, 90s, who are now in the later years. So you have the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel,
right,
with Judi Dench, etc. Phenomenally successful movies.
Absolutely.
I think that audience. So even though the actors are getting older and could be making some of the best films of their careers, the audience getting older doesn't necessarily mean they want to go to the cinema and see films about mortality.
No one wants to take their grandma to a movie that's going to make her force her mortality.
Yeah, exactly.
You want to take her to Danny Collins starring Al Pacino.
Exactly.
There, yeah. I guess you're right that even though there is a market for people to go, for people who want to see people of their age group depicted on screen, it's more like, how can we make old people act like young people? Right.
And so, won't that be funny when they do?
Right?
Oh,
God, yeah. Or, yeah, what if we made an action movie, but we populated it with, you know, old people.
People that are over their prime?
Exactly,
or past their prime?
Yeah, we'll call it Red. Why not?
We'll call it The Expendables.
Yeah, exactly. Ha ha ha. Yeah, so I'm really just like, it kind of boggles the mind, and yet it sells. How much money did the Expendables make? And they made three of them, they all made money.
Yep.
And I mean, it's a little depressing. And yet that isn't people's reaction. People love the novelty of it. I sort of touched on this in my opening statement, but how do you think the aging process is depicted? The difference between the aging process is different between men and women, or do you think they're roughly the same? Kind of what kind of stories are told about aging women versus aging men? I mean, I guess you kind of touched on it's The Expendables versus Last Marigold Hotel is kind of to me like the perfect contrast, right?
And I haven't seen the Last Marigold Hotel, but isn't that still like a cast of people from both genders?
Yeah, it's or is that mostly women? It really is. So that's quite equally split. I think that is probably the main thing. You can still be an action hero if you're a man into your 50s. Just dye your hair,
right?
And you know, don't have too many close-ups and have a very good stunt double.
Right.
Whereas, you know, for example, there was no question about Harrison Ford returning for Star Wars to play Han Solo, but there were questions about Carrie Fisher returning to be Princess Leia.
Right, of course.
So there are different expectations and about women aging. Mm-hmm. I think once you actually go into this very small canon of older age, coming of older age films, it is actually quite equally split, maybe. Mm.
Okay.
Because they do tend to be in more independent or art film territories where there are fewer prejudices at play.
Yeah.
But certainly in mainstream cinema, you look at the ages of all of those big tentpole stars who are still getting in fast cars and jumping off cliffs and flying in, you know, mechanical suits and so on. They're all in their 40s and 50s, whereas it's then a scandal when a woman is playing of that age is playing anything similar.
Right, right.
Yeah,
it just does not happen.
No.
Yeah. It's a scandal when a woman plays an action hero. Like, there's a to-do. Like, it doesn't matter of any age. So,
how dare
less.
You put women in my action movie? Why weren't they played by men?
Exactly. Mm. Well, so, I mean, we talked about how, like, people don't want to watch old people on screen, generally speaking. Youth sells, blah, blah, blah. But are there thematic similarities between these sort of coming of old age versus this kind of teen movie sort of genre? Can you? I guess they're both about, one's kind of about discovery and one generally is about rediscovery, maybe, you know?
I think there's a similar hopeful feel to kind of both. Mm-hmm. Like, I think in both, if I'm using some stereotypes here, it starts with the character feeling lost in their own skin, mm-hmm. with where they are, what their place in society is, with a coming of youthful age. It's someone like The Graduate not knowing what they're going to do with their lives.
Right.
And I'm making up a fake one here. Like, let's just picture a guy that just retired. Suddenly he doesn't know what his place in life is anymore.
Sure,
he's been over the hill and he needs to rediscover, like you said, rediscovery, what his new role is going to be, what his new life will be,
right.
and kind of fit into something when the table itself has been completely turned around.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I guess we can jump into some of our favorites. I know I asked us to compose a top five list, but we certainly don't have to kind of list them off. But I'm curious, kind of what jumped into your mind when this topic was first proposed?
So my first one, and this actually, Dave, you said it was you made up that movie, but this is that movie from a feminine perspective. So Things to Come,
yes.
Mia Hansen love French movie from 2 years ago now. That must have come out in the States by now.
Oh yes,
right?
Yeah.
I have not seen this movie, so
it is on Netflix. So
it's just incredible. It's Isabelle Huppert. That she had those two performances in this film and in Elle in the same year, and they couldn't be more different, but both so revelatory. And she has the is it the triple whammy? She retires, her husband cheats on her, and they go through a divorce.
Yeah.
And also reconnects with a young student.
Yeah.
And so she goes through this redefinition of her identity, and it's set over about an 18-month period, a very eventful one, but it is all about her redefining herself. It's got an incredible cat in that. If you're a fan of cats in movies,
both of those movies have cats.
They do.
Indeed.
I'm surprised that my cats have not ruined this podcast yet. There's still time. I shouldn't knock on wood.
Yeah, that's a great example and one that's that treats the subject with a lot of care and respect. And obviously, Huppert is fantastic, as she always is. But Dave, what popped into your mind?
One that literally just popped into my mind right now, so I'm going to talk about it before I forget, is a movie from 2 years ago, I think, 45 years?
Yes, I was wondering if one of you would bring that up.
Oh, brilliant.
I don't know why I forgot about that until you mentioned Isabelle Huppert. I was like, wait a second, Charlotte Rampling! 45 years is great because you have these people that just a couple years prior, this is when they're celebrating their 45th anniversary, and Charlotte Rampling realizes that perhaps the life that she's lived this whole time, it's been one-sided, her entire marriage with her husband, because he's been caught up on something this whole time, and it's just coming to surface now. And that's something you couldn't have with young people. It just would not work. This is something that's truly reflective of the years that have passed, and really tragic in the fact that it could have all been a lie.
Right, right, yeah. I mean, I know we talked about kind of the different definitions of old age and this sort of transitionary period, but there is something so, as you say, tragic about that particular age where it's like you kind of reached the point of no return, and then taking stock of everything, what kind of life can you have after that? Is there happiness after a life of lies, essentially? Right?
Or do you just continue the lie?
Or do you just continue? Yeah. Exactly.
You've already done it for 45 years. What's another however right. many you have left.
Right, yeah.
That's such an interesting pair to come up with straight off the bat, because Things to Come is, I think, eventually more hopeful about having quite a major change in your life.
Right, right. Okay, so do we want to do... Let's do top three, because I think we're a little short on time here. But let's pick three. Let's start with number three, if you got it. Okay, so for me, the first thing that popped into my mind is Umberto D, the Vittorio De Sica film. And it's not so much him transitioning into the next phase of his life, but rather him deciding whether he wants to continue to live. And the movie is kind of unrelentingly depressing up until the end. but there's an adorable dog.
This is a double whammy of being a sad old man movie and a sad dog movie.
It's so true. Oh, it's brutal.
It's one of the roughest watches out there.
Yes. Oh, it's so good, though. I love that movie so much. It's kind of the quintessential neo-realist film. It just packs such an emotional wallop. But, yeah, so good. but, Michael, how about you?
So... I'm going to go for a film that is related to Wild Strawberries because it's a road movie. However, they're not driving in an old Swedish car. The choice transport here is a lawnmower.
Yes.
This is The Straight Story, the David Lynch movie everyone seems to forget from the mid-late 90s. Richard Farnsworth I think he's in his 90s in this film, isn't he? He's even older than Sjostrom in Wild Strawberries. Getting on his lawnmower and driving across state to visit his brother, who he's hurt, is terminally ill.
Yeah.
And that is, similar to Wild Strawberries in the sense that it's about the journey and you find out little bits about the character and the way he relates to other people that he meets along the way. And it's just such a brilliant film, and one that, now that Twin Peaks is back and it seems that David Lynch is going deeper and deeper into his avant-garde side, I think it's time to look back on his least avant-garde film.
Yeah.
And it's the one I haven't seen. Lovely. Oh, one of the few I haven't seen.
Okay.
I need to check that out.
Check it out. It's lovely.
It's wonderful.
It sounds perfect.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. David Lynch is capable of such loveliness. But you might not know it from what he's best known for. But I think that film is fantastic.
And it's not so divorced from the rest of his style. You still have that sense of Americana. You still have an Ennio Morricone score. You have Harry Dean Stanton in a small role. So there's still a lot of crossover. It's not something that is such a curveball. That it's nothing like his other films. It's still quite an important one in his body of work.
Absolutely. All right, Dave. Number three.
I'm going to keep the depressing track going with... Leo McCarthy's Make Way for Tomorrow.
Ah, okay.
That one is rough. About an older married couple that can't afford to live in their house anymore, and their children just don't want to deal with them. They just keep getting moved along and separated and just want to try to reconnect, and it's so sad.
It is so, so sad.
It's such a well-made movie, though, but that's just like the struggles of people growing older, like, is really highlighted there. And I think it's great in that one because it's not just the husband, it's not just the wife, it's both of them both struggling to just try to maintain the normalcy. And it's in that one, like, they were perfectly happy. They could have continued along. They already had things figured out, but circumstance ruined it for them.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. For number two, well, I don't know if this counts, but what do you guys think of The Royal Tenenbaums as a version of this?
I had that as a kind of honorable mention as well. Because that's someone looking back in his life and being like, oh, I was a bad dad. I kind of miss my family. Let's see if I can get that back.
Exactly, yeah. But there's something about it that feels very youthful. It didn't immediately come to mind, but I love that movie.
So do I.
Yeah. Yeah, and Gene Hackman is wonderful.
I think it's my favorite performance from him, too.
Okay, yeah. he's so funny. Yeah, it approaches, like, depression and this sort of next phase of life anxiety with a lot of both levity and pathos, and it's mixed together in that very specific Wes Anderson way. And I adore that film.
It's an incredible movie. It's one of my favorite Anderson movies, and it's so fascinating to revisit it now because it's a perfect kind of turning point. You kind of remember it as being more composed than it is. Mm. It certainly is before he became so kind of focused in every element of his form.
Mm-hmm. It's a little shaggy.
Sorry?
A shaggy Anderson. I like it.
Yeah. It's that subgenre. Some others did come to mind of the sort of the paterfamilias movie, the sort of the older dude head of a dysfunctional family. There seem to be a few of those, the most recent of which, I guess, is going on Netflix soon. It's the new Noah Baumbach movie, the Meyerowitz stories, where it's Dustin Hoffman playing the head of a dysfunctional family. And he's kind of going for a similar Gene Hackman-type role there.
It's good stuff. There's a lot to be mined from that. All right, what do you got for number two?
I'm going to take us back on a feel-bad track.
Okay, great.
And back to France for Michael Haneke's Amour.
Ah, yes. God.
I haven't rewatched this in years, but it's the first one that came to
Why
mind
would
about,
you?
About people, facing the final challenge in life.
Yes.
This old couple who are totally codependent, and then Emmanuel Riva, the wife, suffers a stroke, and Jean-Louis Trintignant has to care for her. And Isabelle Huppert turns up as their daughter as well.
That's right. We've got
things back to things to come.
It's two for two.
But that's just an incredible movie, very sad, but approaches old age with just no apology and doesn't sweeten things at all. Mm-hmm. And I think many of these movies do kind of lean a little bit on the kooky side.
Yeah.
Certainly many movies looking at old age, as we said, why would old people want to go and watch films about mortality? But this is definitely about that and doesn't pull any punches.
Right.
Also, another fascinating thing, Michael Haneke's new movie, Happy End, kind of is a spiritual sequel to it.
He
spoiled the end of Amour to say how, but there's a surprising link between the two.
Okay, all right. I would say I'm looking forward to that, but I'm not.
It's a very hard movie, but quite fun for a Michael Haneke movie.
God. Really, I'll believe it when I see it. Yeah. Okay, all right. Dave, you got a number two?
I'll go a little happier. I'll go with Pixar's Up.
Oh,
yeah.
Yay!
Because who would have thought that a kid's movie about an old guy would be so good?
Oof. That's also pretty rough.
Oh, my God, the first five minutes. That's like the litmus test for having a human soul.
Yeah, basically.
It's how you react to that first 5 minutes where you see an entire life flash before your eyes. And oh, my God. That's great, because that's one that's not just like, I'm old, I'm gonna die now. It's like, oh, I'm old, maybe I'm capable of doing more than I thought I was before.
Exactly.
And kind of you see Carl become more youthful through the film in his adventure.
Right.
Even though it's pretty whimsical and youthful to tie your house to balloons and fly away, but it's still heart-wrenching. Everything that happens before he flies away.
I've heard a lot of people dismiss that movie, saying, you know, like, the first 5 minutes are great, but the rest of it's just, you know, regular dumb kids movie. And I'm just
that is not
true. There's so much left. There's still, like, that's the whole point of the movie, is the next 40, or what is it? How long is that movie? 70 minutes, you know?
Maybe it is 90 minutes. They're pretty economical.
That's true,
with their run times.
That is true. Yeah, that's a great example. I love that movie. As far as my number one, these rankings are, as always, pretty arbitrary, and there are a few more that I want to mention. But first, I'll just say the number one for me is The Beaches of Agnes. Agnes Varda made a documentary about her career, and it's sort of a reflection. A look back on all of the projects she's been involved with and all the people she's met and all the people she's loved and lost. And it's beautiful. And it sort of follows a kind of similar structure as Wild Strawberries. She literally flashes back. She has old trimmings from old movies, just old unused footage, actual footage, and it's interspliced throughout. And again, it's about remembrance. And at the end of the movie, she's, you know, as long as I'm alive, I'll remember. And really beautiful. Yeah, so
her new movie is incredible. It's called Visage Village. It premiered in Cannes. And she's just, I want her to be my grandma.
Right? She's the coolest.
And that's a movie that is about her and this visual artist going around the countryside in France doing large format photography of farmers and villagers and so on. But then in the third act, it takes such a kind of melancholy turn where she goes quite inward and she says, oh, I tell you what, let's go and visit Jean-Luc Godard. I know where he lives. And she goes in this like interior journey, talking about her history of how she hasn't spoken to him in 20 years and everything. What? And suddenly you just see this, you just feel this weight of history and legacy that rests on the shoulders of these few French filmmakers. But she is coming into it. She has amazing hair nowadays as well.
Her hair is
great.
Oh, so true. Beaches of Agnes is great. She hasn't stopped making films, and all of them are worth seeing, and I'm definitely looking forward to seeing the new one. But Michael, what you got for number one?
So my number one, this isn't, as I said, this isn't old as in 65 and up. This is more like middle age movie. But I'll take any opportunity I can to hype Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan.
Yes.
Which is one of my all-time favourite movies and would definitely make it into my Sight and Sound top 10 if I ever were going to contribute.
A lot of Star Trek references on this show.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah,
Isaac himself.
Yes.
Trying to assimilate everyone on the Swedish countryside.
Perfect.
Thank you. All right. Go
but
on.
I find the Wrath of Khan does what all of those movies starring Tom Cruise, etc., doesn't do, which is look at these action heroes and present them as approaching middle age and what that may mean for them. Mm. It starts with Captain Kirk celebrating a birthday and being given as a gift a pair of reading glasses because his eyesight is going. Mm. And it's this sense runs throughout the film that maybe the crew of the Enterprise are past the age where they should be going through the galaxies, seeking out new life and new civilizations.
Yeah.
But it pulls it together really well at the end with a very melancholy final few scenes where it's the film where Spock dies, and it's through that and through a few other elements of the plot with Kirk's estranged lover and son that he feels young again and feels ready to go out on new adventures. And it's such an incredible movie that it's almost ever so slightly cheapened by the fact that they then made four more movies with the same cast getting older and fatter.
Actually, the fourth Star Trek movie is the best one.
Voyage Home is fantastic. It's not aesthetically pure for me at this point.
Yes, I mean, if they had ended right there, we wouldn't have Voyage Home. So, you know, like, just keep that in mind. But yes,
let's,
you're right.
Stop at Voyage Home. I'd say
That's fair. Okay, that's enough Star Trek anyway. We could really get into it. That's another show. But Dave, number one.
Number one is obviously Clint Eastwood's 2000 movie Space Cowboys.
Yes,
no.
Of course.
No, I'm going to do, even though I could do Gran Torino, because I actually do like that movie, even though I'm not the biggest Clint Eastwood fan, Charlie Chaplin's Limelight.
Okay.
Yeah. Talk about sad old man movies,
yes.
In which Charlie Chaplin, if he never became famous, tries to put on one last show and lets Buster Keaton in on the act. I think that movie alone is worth seeing just for that scene at the end where Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin are on stage together.
Right.
But the whole movie, I think that really puts together, what is it Orson Welles that said Charlie Chaplin's movies are like the snappiest moments ever strung between like giant pillars of genius. And that movie is no exception to that. There are some moments that are a little much, but I'm a big Charlie Chaplin fan, and I think that movie itself has a really good, just, I know it's not his last movie, but it's almost like a send-off to his vaudeville days.
Sure.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
There's such a sincerity and earnestness to his filmmaking that I love, and I think is kind of out of fashion.
Very much so.
There's a bit in that movie which always sticks to my mind where it's like he's, you know, my home is the theatre. I thought you hated the theatre. And he says, I also hate the sight of blood, but it runs in my veins.
Yeah.
And it's just such kind of sledgehammer writing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It really works. And
but it's sledgehammer writing at its best.
Yeah. At its best, yes.
All right. Well, I guess before we wrap up this topic, are there any other honorable mentions? Just real quickly.
I'm surprised no one said Harold and Maude.
Right? Yeah.
I thought that is more of a coming of young age movie.
Right.
I was close.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably why I skipped it as well. But it is a twin coming of age movie,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Right. Right. I know I mentioned this at the beginning, but Whatever Happened to Baby Jane is one of my favorite movies of all time. And we've talked about Sunset Boulevard. But again, I don't really like to classify those films as old age movies, even though that's exactly what they're about. And they're about, especially Baby Jane, I just think about like the meta-textual nature of it and how it's almost these women defying Hollywood and saying, you know, yeah, we're old, but you're going to look at us anyway. I appreciate, but I guess it didn't feel right to have that one butting up against The Beaches of Agnes. But, <you know. laughs> but anyway, so yeah, I guess listeners can tell us if we're missing any. That's enough about aging and death for one episode. Let's close things out with some youthful frivolity. Dave, I'm going to start with you. What's one piece of pop culture you've been digging lately?
Does this need to be something recent?
No.
It does not need to be something recent.
Absolutely does not.
Okay, because I'm going to go with something that's actually kind of old, but just kind of came into my my line of sight, at least, because it just got a Blu-ray release. It's a 1961 movie called Spotlight on a Murderer.
Okay.
That I had never heard of before, from French director Georges Franju, and written by, I'm going to butcher their names, they're the guys that wrote Vertigo and Diabolique. It's the team Narjak and Bolu, or Bolu and Narjak. And basically, it's the story of, it's like an Agatha Christie story of an old man that's about to die, but he hides in a hidden compartment in his ancient castle. And his descendants all want to collect his will, but they can't unless he's been found or been missing for 5 years. So they are trying to turn his old estate into a money-making kind of like museum, when suddenly, one by one, they start meeting a grisly fate.
That sounds intriguing. Give me the name again.
Spotlight on a Murderer. It's not a perfect movie, but I think simply because I like everyone involved in it and I really like the premise, it's kind of like, it seems like it could be the perfect movie. Even if it falls a little bit short, I think it's completely worth mentioning because I've never heard anyone else talk about it.
All right. Well, thank you for bringing it to our attention. Michael, what you got?
So I recently rewatched a movie that is one of my favorites of the year. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, and it's called The Square, which is the new film by Ruben Östlund, who is it's a Swedish movie to tie in with Wild Strawberries. It's a sort of let's say a wayward satirical comedy set in the art world in Stockholm around an opening of a new art exhibit. And particularly focusing in on the chief curator and various ways in which his masculinity is undermined throughout the film. And I think Ruben Östlund is really becoming the master filmmaker of examining modern masculinity. His previous film, which is the one I'd probably recommend because it's probably more available, is Force Majeure.
Okay.
I don't know if you saw that a few years ago.
Yes.
Which has an incredible setup where it's a family vacationing at a ski resort, and what looks like an avalanche comes towards them when they're having dinner on a terrace, but actually it was a controlled explosion. But as the snow races towards them, the father runs off and leaves the family to their uncertain fate.
But he grabbed his cell phone.
And then the rest of the film is just him dealing with that act, denying that act, and then coming to terms with that act.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic, and I'd recommend watching that and then looking out for the square as it comes along.
Yeah, I'm definitely excited for that. Keep an eye out. Yeah, that sounds fantastic. And I think they're remaking Force Majeure.
Are they?
I believe so.
Gross.
Yeah. Of course, because we can't watch anything with subtitles.
It's so interesting because I think that both Force Majeure and The Square, his sense of humor is so... I don't want to say his sense of humor is so British, but it's so familiar to the British sense of humor. Mm. It's his characters, his male characters, and the way that it's all about hubris and performed identity and so on, and social contracts. It so plays into the tradition of Ricky Gervais and Steve Coogan's Alan Partridge and so on.
Right.
And I would be very interested to see how his films would be remade in the States.
We'll find a way to mess them up, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. No, it'll be louder, that's for sure. Yeah. All right. Well, so I've been traveling a lot lately. You might have noticed that the Twitter account has been a little bit quieter than usual. And as a result, I haven't really been taking in a lot of contemporary culture. So I'll do a little cheat and do one that I've done. I believe I've mentioned this one before, but... In Los Angeles, we do have a free Shakespeare in the Park festival every summer, and I was able to take in the opening night of this year's festival, which is Measure for Measure, the Shakespeare play, and it's just such a delight to be able to go and experience these wonderful actors performing this play, especially Measure for Measure, which is not one that is as frequently put on as, you know, say Hamlet or Macbeth or, you know, the usual. But actually, it proved to be very timely. Lots of very contemporary themes in it, just as there are with most of Shakespeare's work. So I know Shakespeare in the Park's been getting a lot of play recently because of certain allusions to contemporary political figures, and they're certainly doing that in the one in Los Angeles. Perhaps not quite as overtly, but it plays very, very well in our current political landscape. And it doesn't have to be Los Angeles. I just would encourage people to go and seek out any kind of free outdoor festival in their town, because I'm pretty sure if you live in a city, this is a pretty common occurrence. And, you know, Michael, you should go and check out some Shakespeare while you're in London.
Yes, I definitely should. So is Shakespeare in the Park I mean, of course, it's a real thing. Is it a respected thing? Because from American pop culture, it's generally held up as something out-of-work actors do. There's a line in one of the Woody Allen films, which is, I did Shakespeare in the Park, I got mugged.
Right. Yeah,
so is it a proper thing?
I guess it depends on where you are. If you're in New York, that is absolutely a proper thing. I think it's it gets mocked. It's sort of... a kind of paying your dues kind of reputation, right? It's something young actors do in order to learn the craft. You go and do free Shakespeare in the Park. This company in Los Angeles has been doing it for many years now, and I think they're really terrific, and they have proper sets, and generally speaking, the audiences are really respectful and receptive to these presentations. So there might be reason for mockery if you've got, you know, the sort of Waiting for Guffman style small town people putting on a play. But I mean, even that might be worth checking out. It's just like it's such a feat to be able to perform Shakespeare. There's something so familiar yet foreign about it. I don't know. It's just I always feel like it's worth checking out. No matter the kind of the relative quality of the of the performance, the words are still basically the same. And speaking of traveling, you know, I just want to give a shout out to Europe for being amazing. You go, Europe. You know, if you ever get a chance, go. It's great.
My country may not seem to back me up on this, but I really like Europe.
Okay. And, you know, UK, I know UK wants to set itself apart from Europe.
51%. I mean,
it's made it, sure, yeah. But a shout out to the UK, too. You know, that's where Shakespeare comes from and everything. Mm-hmm. So they have lots of good art. Shout out to Claude Monet. He's pretty great.
I prefer my paintings to be in American.
Right, right. Ay, ay, ay. All right. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what do you make of Ingmar Bergman's Wild Strawberries? Come do some armchair psychoanalyzing on our website, flickswise.com. And you can like us and leave us a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. And if you have any coming-of-old-age movies you want to throw into the mix, you should tell us about them on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, please, please go to iTunes or the pod playing app of your choice and subscribe, rate us, leave us a nice comment. If we've learned anything here today, it's that life is short and you don't want to be on your deathbed regretting not having given us a good rating on iTunes. So, yeah, just go do it. These just keep getting darker and darker. I apologize. Anyway, on our next show, I am extremely pleased, excited to announce that Carol screenwriter Phyllis Nage will be returning to the show. We got great feedback on our previous episode with Phyllis, which if you haven't already listened to that, what are you waiting for? Go do it. It's great. It's all about Carol, and we talk a lot about Isabel Huppert, which apparently that's all we do on this show. I mean, yeah, she's the best. So, but I'm very, very excited to have Phyllis back. This time, we're talking Wilder. Fans of Carol will recall that there's a whole scene in the movie where Therese goes to see Sunset Boulevard, and that's where the projectionist kind of explains subtext to her, and by extension, the audience. And, well, hopefully there's more where that came from, because Sunset Boulevard is the 63rd movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, which we've mentioned. And so Phyllis and I are gonna delve in and get real deep into the subtext. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, Michael, thank you so much for joining us on today's show.
Thanks for asking me back.
And if listeners are curious about your various film endeavors, where can they find more information?
Well, I'm on Twitter as Michael J. Leader, spelled L-E-A-D-E-R. And I've recently just set up a website for MISC Films, which is the programming outfit collective that I run with my colleague Rowan Woods. That's miscfilms.com.
Perfect. And Dave, thanks for being our Bergman expert.
Anytime. Okay. Anytime you need a Bergman expert, even when it's not called for, I will be there.
Excellent. And where can folks find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at Cinema versus Dave. That is Cinema vs. Dave. And I have nothing else important going on.
Nonsense.
It's just
not
Twitter
on the internet. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, make sure to follow Twitter. Twitter is always very important.
Anyway, it's the most important thing.
The most important. Yes. All right. Well, until next time, guys. Sweet dreams.